Welcome to the Cycling Podcast and our coverage of the 2025 Tour de France, brought to you in association with Wahoo. A very big thank you to Wahoo for supporting us all the way to Paris and beyond, because they'll also be sponsoring our coverage of the Tour de France Fam next week. Now, the riders wearing the yellow and green jerseys this morning, Tadej Pogacar and Jonathan Milan, use the Element Bolt 3 cycle computer and the tracker heart rate monitor by Wahoo. Wahoo are not just about the gear though, not just about the kit, they've also built a full training platform to help you improve. The Wahoo app is a full training platform that helps you actually understand your own fitness, not just look at numbers. So you get insights into your progress and plans built around your goals. Whether you're just starting out in cycling or you want to sharpen up your performance, it's a great tool to keep your training on track. Go to wahoofitness.com to find out more.
This is the cycling podcast of the 2025 Tour de France with Lionel Burney, Graham Wilcox and friends, brought to you in association with Wahoo. Today we're in Valence.
Little Trek's Tom Squinge there, Lionel, giving it the big one back at the team bus after another powerful win for Jonathan Milan in the green jersey. Milan's on fire. Is Tadej Pogacar terrified?
Well, we'll have to get into the maths of the green jersey competition a little bit later on. But, I mean, that singing there took me back to your experience in the Caravan of Love, the publicity caravan, and all the young people getting into the swing of things before their day out entertaining the crowds. I mean, very upbeat energy from Squinge there. But let's face it, Jonathan Milan, well, he was the bowling ball that survived while all of the pins fell around him.
Skittled around him, yeah, absolutely. We will get into that. First of all, where are we? A slightly eccentric base for today's pod.
Not the most luxurious of surroundings. I don't want to be too unkind, but we're in a bit of a functional hotel on a trading estate on the edge of Valence. The race didn't really go into the centre, which is pretty attractive actually, but it finished on one side of the town. We've come around to the other side of the town. We're in one of these sort of concrete boxes. I mean, it's perfectly nice, but we're sort of perched slightly awkwardly in reception. People are checking in around us, so you might hear a bit of disruption as they check in. We've moved away from the pool table just in case somebody puts a euro in and they start clacking balls around behind us. But we're sort of perched rather awkwardly, a little bit more. Yeah, we're standing out a bit here, aren't we? It's not what we used to. We want to be recording out in the wild,
indeed,
like we were yesterday on Mont Ventoux.
How's your pool game?
Not too bad, but
not too bad.
Probably a bit rusty. Are we going to find out later?
That was my hope. Mention for Valence, because the last time I think the Tour was here was for Mark Cavendish's 33rd win in 2021. He'd already opened his account with wins in Fougères and Châteauroux.
That's right.
That year. And as the Tour headed for the Alps, he bagged his 33rd here, led out by Julien Alaphilippe.
Yeah, I remember it well because I arrived on the Tour that day. I took the TGV down to Valence from Paris, I think it was, and it was delayed, so I missed the finish. I had to watch it on my phone on a stationary train, and Richard Moore had all sorts of fun at my expense because Mark Cavendish arrived at express train speed into the town, and I most certainly didn't. But yes, here we are again, another sprint finish in Valence, and a pretty dramatic one, really, wasn't it?
It was. Should we do the tale of the etape and get into it?
Yes, indeed. Well, it was stage 17 from Bolen to Valence, 160.4 kilometres, so it's going to be a rapid one. And the breakaway went pretty early, didn't it? Four riders.
146 kilometres to go. Vincenzo Albanese for EF Education Easy Post, Quintin Pasha for Groupama FDJ, Matthew Bergado for Total Energies, and Jonas Abrahamsson, the ever-willing Jonas Abrahamsson, for Uno X Mobility. They were the riders who struck out, and they got themselves a gap of about 2 minutes 40 seconds.
Not an awful lot. Abrahamsson, of course, already won a stage in this Tour. I'd been speculating yesterday about whether the intermediate sprint might make it very difficult for any kind of break to get away, but I guess Lidl Trek thought, well, four riders up the road, they're not taking too many points away from Jonathan Milan. Milan took the sprint for fifth and got 11 points, which may well be crucial for him. Then the break stayed away all day. There was some rain. It was heavy at times. It was light at times. And with 20 kilometres to go, the gap was coming down. With about 10 kilometres to go, Abrahamson attacked on his own and was chased by Albanese, and the other two got caught by the bunch. And then Abrahamson was last man standing, caught finally with 4.5 kilometres to go. There was then this tricky run-in with four roundabouts, and they looked like they'd negotiated all of those absolutely fine. And then as they went under the 1 kilometre to go banner, there was a stack right in the middle, quite close to the front, and only 10 riders or so got through. Everybody else held up. Tim Malia of Sudal Quickstep, stage winner twice so far in this race, he was held up. But lots of riders hit the deck, and really it was sort of three sort of A-list sprinters, if you like, Jonathan Milan, Arnaud Delis and Jordi Meus, who got through a very strange looking sprint with sort of eight or nine riders contesting it, and Milan won it, I think, quite comfortably. Second stage win of the tour after galloping into Laval, what feels like a lifetime ago. Jordi Meus of Red Bull second, Tobias Lund Andersen of Picnic Post NL third, Delis was fourth for Lotto, Ballerini fifth for XDS Astana. And, well, everybody else was picking themselves up off the deck.
So no Tim Malia for Sudal Quickstep and no Biniam Gumai for Intermarché Wanty.
No, and he looked like he'd hit the ground quite hard. He was sitting up against the barriers for a little while. Of course, inside the 3 kilometre to go, so, you know, not any urgency to get back up. But, yeah, it was a, well, it was one of those crashes, wasn't it? Once somebody touched brakes, they were all going to go down. The overall standings unaffected by today's race. The King of the Mountains is still tied between Tadej Pogacar and Lenny Martinez. So Pogacar in yellow, of course. Lenny Martinez will wear polka dots tomorrow into the Alps. But the green jersey competition, I think Milan has stretched it enough by taking those 61 points today. He's now on 312. Pogacar is on 240. The gap is now 72. And I think one more nudge and Milan should get it. With the very, you know, in brackets bit, he's got to get over those Alpine stages. One non-starter today, Danny van Poppel of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe.
So I caught up with a couple of people around the little Trek bus at the end when it was absolutely hooning with rain. They were, for obvious reasons, unperturbed by the wet weather. It really all went for them today. Not only did they pick up the intermediate sprint points, but fantastic win for Milan at the end there. So Tom Squinge was arguably the most animated, well, audibly the most animated, as we heard at the top there, of the little Trek crew when I got down to the team buses after the race. He can't help himself but throw in the odd sort of sarcastic response just to throw you, but he's great value. Here he is now.
What a win for your team, Jonathan Milan. It's impossible to stop him.
Did he win? Nah, I mean, yeah, it was. We knew it was going to be a hard day to pull it off because we knew that a lot of guys were going to go in the break. So, of course, for the break was a big battle. And then, obviously, on the first Cat 4 or whatever Cat climb, they really went hard and tested us again. And again, we had to chase. In the last 5K, I was praying that nobody crashes, and then that we win.
Tell us about that chase. It was a very long chase, and the breakaway guys, they put in a massive effort.
Yeah, I mean, you know, four guys on a parkour like this, with the guys that were there, you knew it was going to be a hard one. Yeah, well, we gave it all. It was not easy, for sure.
And it seems he has his own song here.
Yeah, there's different versions of that song, but yes, Johnny on Fire is one of them. Thank you.
Pretty much a perfect day for you, Tom, taking the intermediate sprint points that were left after the break as well.
No, I mean, if we went 1-2-3, that would be better.
But still, what was there?
If we went 1-2-3, sure. That'd be perfect.
I mean, did you talk about that at breakfast this morning? Presumably not. That was
going 1-2-3 in the stage? I don't know.
Talk to me about the rest of the race. Do you think Johnny's got the green jersey for keeps now, or do you think you're still going to have to work quite hard?
It's going to be a battle. It's for sure going to be a battle. I think it's going to end up sprinting in Paris for it.
Even with Montmartre, you're going to have to work hard for those last three climbs before the 6Ks, before the end?
For sure. I don't think it's going to be an easy sprint that day either. There's no easy sprints nowadays, so we're going to give it all for sure.
Can you already walk away from the race feeling like the team's had a good tour?
We'll talk about, it's been a good tour for sure, but you always want more and you always chase more. It's not that we have three stages left and we're going to leave on the bus to Paris already, you know. So for sure we're going to keep chasing. There's still an opportunity for a break. Quinn's got great legs, so for sure he can do something on that stage. And then, Sunday in Paris is going to be another one.
He was man of the match for you today.
100%. He was, as they say, on fire.
Never mind the combativity award, Graham. I think there should be a chanteur du jour award for best singer on the tour. So far he's got the golden microphone there, Tom Squins, of Lidl Trek.
I'm going to try and give him a bit of a run for his money. Quinn Simmons also on fire today. I felt like every time I looked up, he was on the front of the race. We'll get into that in part two. First of all, shall we hear from our man with the whiteboard, Matt White?
Well, stage 17 delivered another aggressive and exciting day, and probably the last chance for the pure sprinters in this year's Tour de France. Well, the weather started off well, but ended not so well. We had a wet final, and in these wet finals, especially for the sprint stages, the risk the guys have to take is immense. And with those four roundabouts coming into the final, I think the bunch did quite well to navigate through the roundabouts without any crashes. But it's argy-bargy sprinting, and how the crash happened just inside the 1 kilometer to go banner is, one of the post NL rider just got squeezed from either side, and then it's a domino effect. Anyone who touched the brakes then ended up on the deck, and we ended up seeing only 10 to 12 riders actually contest the sprint without some of the major favorites, including Tim Merlier. What can teams do to mitigate risk in those situations? I suppose that all starts when the rain comes down, and that's keeping your GC rider or your lead sprinter as close to the front as possible in an efficient way. And then also you need a little bit of luck. Jonathan Milan made a great move on his own just before that 1 kilometer to go banner, which then put him out of risk and avoided the crash. But, people haven't got crystal balls, but you do need that element of luck in sprints and an element of judgment. And it was a nervous, hectic sprint today, but Jonathan Milan prevailed and now has a very, very handy lead going into the last couple of stages to cement that green jersey win.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Saily, which is a new eSIM service app which is brought to you by the creators of NordVPN. So when you travel abroad and you take your mobile phone, you want to use your phone as if you were at home. Everybody wants to keep in touch with their friends and family while they're away. Get on Instagram to post pictures of glorious locations. And sometimes when you're abroad, the data roaming and the call charges can really rack up. So an eSIM is the way to go. Previously, you had to go to the airport and go to a shop and buy a SIM, a physical thing, and put it in your phone. And it's not a lot of faff. But an eSIM from Saily will save you all of that trouble. You only have to download the app once, and then you pick the plan to cover the places you're going. There are affordable prices, significantly reducing or even eliminating roaming fees, and you can have a plan that covers up to 190 countries. Are there even 190 countries? I think there probably are. Anyway, save time. Don't wait at the airport to go and buy yourself a physical SIM card. And you will also be protecting your privacy with the Saily eSIM, because it's brought to you by the people behind NordVPN. So internet security is their watchword. So how do you get yourself a Saily eSIM? Well, the best way is to download the Saily app in your app store, and it's spelled S-A-I-L-Y. Use the code cycling at checkout and you'll get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Alternatively, go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling.
So it was all about the green jersey today, Lionel, for obvious reasons. Paris creeping closer, as you said, still got that small detail of the Alps to come, starting with tomorrow's Queen stage. It feels a bit strange in a way that we're already talking about Paris, but because of the nature of how the race has unfolded, and because that is the next possible sprint stage, that's where we're at.
I think that's pushing it. I mean, lots of people are saying that the three climbs of Montmartre on Sunday will eliminate the big sprinters. So I think it's all going to come down to the strategy from this point on. The big thing in Jonathan Milan's favour is that the two intermediate sprints in the next 2 days come very early. Tomorrow is after 23 kilometres. And on Friday, it's after 8 kilometres. And Lidl Trek will have the resources to hold everything together until that point and give Milan the chance of getting himself a maximum 40 points. Remember, the points at the stage finishes when it's in the mountains, and even on Saturday, when it's kind of intermediate type stage rolling, they are reduced. So there's only 20 on offer at the finish on Thursday and Friday, and 30 on offer on Saturday. There's still 50 on the line on the Champs-Élysées. So if it did go the way of Tadej Pogacar, then you could imagine he could potentially get those points. But I'm starting to think that Milan and Lidl Trek will get it done in those two intermediate sprints tomorrow and Friday, and it will just be out of Pogacar's reach.
I think I'm also right in saying there are intermediate sprint points up for grabs on Sunday on the way to the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah, there are 20 on the Champs-Élysées before they have to go over the three climbs of Montmartre. So realistically, Milan has three opportunities to get 20 points. That's another 60. That would put it well out of Pogacar's reach. So it's just a numbers game now for Lidl Trek, and I think they can feel fairly confident. Milan's climbing pretty well as well. We saw the time trial stage on Périgueux. He was one of the sprinters who did pretty well. You know, better certainly than Melia, better than Gamay, I think.
Would have finished inside the original time cut.
He would have done, yeah, whereas the other two wouldn't have done. So, you know, I don't think there's any doubt really he's going to get over those mountains. You know, he's got over the mountains in the Giro twice to win the points competition. So I don't think that's a worry. It's just about making sure you can put it out of Pogacar's reach just in case something extraordinary happens. You know, if he were not to score over the next 2 days and Pogacar was to get, what's that, 90 points, then it might be touch and go. But I just can't see it now. I think Milan's done very, very well. And it's been a calm, sensible job by them.
Absolutely. He wasn't actually the first person to cross the line today, though. Our photographer and, saviour from Monfanti, Simon Gill, told us when he returned to the press room, because a gentleman in a Decathlon Azure Désert replica jersey crossed the line, somehow managed to get onto the course, crossed the line first, went for a full-on sprint. These pictures are out there. Crossed the line first, but as he did so, he was knocked off his bike by a race official and a gendarme. And once again, they weren't mucking about.
No, well, they don't muck about because, you know, the security issues around the tour are, you know, they're not for fun, are they? The course is locked down and kept secure and safe for the riders. I mean, it reminds me of the difference in kind of attitudes, because 25 years ago, in 2000, I was at Courchevel when, I forget who won the stage, but there was a real moment of confusion because two riders, from memory, one in a Kelmay jersey and one in a Festina jersey, I think, they were just amateur cyclists, had got onto the course and were sprinting up the finish straight. And there was a bit of a kind of, oh, this is a jolly jape, you know, oh, ha, 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 kind of attitude back in the day. But I think people getting onto the course for any reason, you know, I think they're risking being dealt with pretty severely, as we saw from the images of the cyclist being basically wrestled to the ground off two wheels.
And after the protester in Toulouse too. So,
there's a thing, isn't there? Like, you know, do you remember in football when there was a guy who kind of made almost a sort of name for himself by getting into sporting events? He walked out to bat at Lord's or something, didn't he, in cricket? And he got onto the team group photo of a Manchester United Champions League game. And there was a kind of a sense of, oh, isn't this great? Well done. He's evaded security and got... But I think that we operate in different times now. You don't know the ideas and the motives behind anyone getting on the course. And so the risk taken is that the authorities will deal really harshly with what's happening in front of them, and they'll be asking questions later.
There's a punter who got onto the pitch. I can't remember for which team, but he scored and ran off celebrating, and all the players went to celebrate with him because not even they realised.
I mean, there are certain teams in the peloton, maybe they could get a member of the public to put on a replica jersey and get over the line first. For some of them, it might be their best chance of a win this week.
But,
I shouldn't make light of a situation. I mean, like I say, it's all good fun until the authorities, you know, take the measures that they have to make, because they don't know in the moment what's going on, do they?
So. They don't. But thanks to Simon, we caught that one. What we did catch yesterday but didn't say was that Jonas Vingegaard was another rider who crossed the line, was knocked off his bike, legitimately crossed the line, was knocked off his bike by another photographer. And I mean, this is a sort of part corrections corner from us, just because in the madness of Vaughan 2 and the fatigue between us in the van, we didn't mention this on yesterday's pod.
We probably missed a whole host of things yesterday. I mean, I described it as epic, which is very much not Cycling Podcast house style.
I thought you would pull me up for that because I said it in my interview with Ben Healy. But I'm glad we both said it. That was a wipe my brow moment for me.
Yeah.
So back to today's race, and not before time. Greggy Rast was another man in good humour around the Little Trek bus. He was looking for Stephen de Jong, one of the Little Trek DSs. Here's Greggy on today's win while he was looking for Stephen.
Greggy Rast, Little Trek, while you're looking for Stephen.
He's the man.
Well, the man today was John Milan, and presumably that was mission accomplished today for you.
Yeah, it was... Again, a really hard piece of work, because Quickstep was really committed and we was, and then some other teams helped a little bit, but there was a really strong group. Ineos also tried to do something in the middle of the race. He was a bit in trouble, so it was a lot of work, but yeah, the mission is accomplished.
Talk to me about the crash at the end there, very sketchy moment. Fortunately for you, it seemed to happen behind Jonathan Milan, so he got out without any damage. But nevertheless, on a rainy day, it must have been a nervous sort of final 50Ks coming into Valence.
Yeah, I mean, we knew about all the roundabouts, of course, and it's wet, it's slippery, and I mean, it's a good chance something will happen. And in this case, we was lucky, we was in the front of it, at least with Jasper and Johnny. So this was our luck today.
On the radio, were you telling your boys, sort of, you know, ease off, take it easy, get there in one piece, and then we'll contest the sprint when we get there?
No, I mean, they went all in to go first into the corner, and then they lost each other a bit. There was the big crash, and then there's nothing else you can do.
And just one word on Quinn Simmons. He was exceptional for today. It felt like every time I looked up, he was riding on the front.
Not only today. I mean, he's unbelievably strong, and I think we need, in these days, you need these guys to have the breakaways under control, and he did a fantastic job. And also Thibaut is back on a good level, and Toms did fantastic as well. So the team went deep today to have this. Unfortunately, okay, we miss Simone because he's really damaged from his crashes, but that's how it is. I think there is not many teams with 8 full guys.
So, Graham, it was raining quite heavily when the race was approaching Valence, so I was very glad that you volunteered to go out to the finish line and the buses to go and talk to some people while I sheltered in the press room on other business. Not other business, that comes in a while. But who else did you catch up with outside the team buses?
It was muggy rain as well.
Worst, isn't it? I mean, I'm steaming here now. My T-shirt got all wet walking back to the car, and just be normal weather, you know.
Normal weather for normal men, that's all we ask.
Wet and cold, fine. Warm and dry, fine. Crossing over, not fine.
To answer your question, Jonas Abrahamsson, outside the Uno X bus. All of the teams, for obvious reasons, were keen to get a move on today. I sort of felt like I was slightly on the wrong end of a power trip from the Uno X press officer, but I did grab one quick question with Jonas Abrahamsson. Here he is now.
Jonas, how was that on the front today?
Yeah, it was fun to be out there, and I have good legs, so then it's always nice to be in the front. And the peloton was very close a lot of times, but we hold the gap. And in the end there, the peloton was so close, so I tried to go solo, but I was catched with 4 kilometers to go. So
were you always?
We had to deal with
Sorry, mate.
It was a real case of nothing to lose riding by Jonas Abrahamsson, wasn't it? He might have ridden differently had it not been the case that he already had a stage win under his belt. And as it was, you know, he did quite a lot of work in the break to keep the time gap as it was and give them a chance. And he stayed out until 4.5 to go. Not too bad. I mean, it was never going to work, really, was it?
But yeah, it felt like lost cause riding to me.
But the weather tipped the balance back in the favour of the breakaways, because especially with that tricky run in around all the roundabouts, I think he was probably thinking, if I can just get into, you know, 3, 2.5 to go, Git might have had a chance to stay away. But as it was, they caught him before the most technical aspect of the running, which is what they wanted to do to try and eliminate any sort of sense of panic in the finale. But of course, then we saw the touch of brakes and the spill right in the middle. And going back to what Matt White said about you limit your chances of having problems if you're at the front. It's such a cliche in cycling, isn't it? Be at the front and you'll be fine. But on some occasions, being at the front isn't being two rows back. It's literally being in the first five riders. And that's what we saw today. You know, anyone after 10th was going to have their chances wiped out.
The mood was good around the Uno X bus as well, and there was a real kind of feeling, you could sense it, that he had done a really good job for them today.
Any singing?
No. Not even from me. While I was doing that, what were you listening to?
Well, I was at the press conference today. Pogacar came in and he was asked a couple of slightly pointy questions. I mean, fair enough, absolutely fair enough questions. But one of our colleagues asked about some comments made on French television by Jean-René Bernardeau, a longtime sports director and manager of the team that was once Bouygues Telecom, then Europcar, and also Thomas Vauclair, who rode for that team. And they were talking about UAE's perceived arrogance, you know, the way they've kind of been bossing the race. And I sometimes wonder if these guys forget about Bernard Hinault. I mean, if you want to talk about arrogance in the Tour de France, Hinault ruled with an iron fist. He used to say, no, we're not riding until 70 kilometres to go or 50 kilometres to go, and the peloton would just pootle along, all spread across the road. You know, Pogacar's answer was pretty good. He talked about how they're trying to make the race as easy as possible for them, which means eliminating risk, being in the right place at the right time. And if that means that some other teams and riders have a tough time, well, that's kind of the consequence of being in the Tour de France. He did say, which was quite a funny line at the end, he said, I just think people can stay quiet. And I know that will sound super arrogant.
Well, you know, you've got to own it, I suppose, haven't you?
Absolutely. He was then asked about the sponsor, UAE Team Emirates, and his responsibility, all the riders' responsibility to young fans especially. It's kind of a way into this question, isn't it? And the question was framed around a country that sponsored the team that has a complicated human rights record. Let's put it that way. I always refer to the Amnesty International website whenever any of these ethical questions about countries come up. And you can go and have a look at that for yourselves and make up your own mind what you think about the UAE Emirate regime. There are some issues with, you know, freedom of association, freedom of expression, human rights, women's rights especially. It's probably the most uncomfortable I've seen Pogacar look in any Tour de France press conference. You know, he's been asked questions about doping before and he has, you know, had good answers for those and sailed through them. He looked a little bit uncomfortable to be asked this question. I'm sure he would have known it would come at some point. But he talked about how in the 5 or 6 years that he's been riding for the team, it's a bit longer than that, isn't it? But, you know, he's seen the development of cycling in the UAE, the improved infrastructure, the way that cycling is being marketed as a, you know, a lifestyle choice for people.
Pogacar said, kids love us, the locals love us. When we ride with them, the sport is growing in the UAE, which I guess is why they have the team to promote a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely fair enough. I mean, I remember a few years ago on the cycling podcast, we did an episode called The Ethical Report, where we went through all of the sponsors in the World Tour and kind of talked about the pros and cons of each sponsoring company, whether it was a primary sponsor or a secondary sponsor. I mean, it was an episode or a couple of episodes that really split opinion. Some people think that if companies or countries are prepared to put money into cycling, they should be encouraged and nothing should happen to discourage that investment in the sport. Others think that sport like cycling and other sports, but cycling especially is a slightly low-hanging fruit in that it is cheaper than, you know, I don't know, Premier League football or Formula One or whatever. It's an opportunity to kind of cleanse reputation, sports washing, green washing, however you want to put it. And I think there's elements of truth on both sides of that. From my part, I think back to when I was a kid and what I was inspired by in cycling. I mean, I must admit, I read through the magazine to see what Panasonic did. I mean, I knew what Panasonic did. They make televisions and radios, if you remember those back in the day, or Zed Peugeot. You know, Zed was a children's clothing store. La Vie Claire was a health food chain in France. I think if you do that today and you list out all of the sponsors and you write down exactly what they do, I mean, you've got a collection of nation states, you've got multinational companies that are into, you know, less than green energy, you've got lots of companies from the petrochemical industry, and but then you've got a supermarket and you've got other companies as well. I think it is a conversation worth having, and I think it is a valid question for Pogacar. He's riding round advertising the UAE in the biggest bike race in the world. Just one other thing though. Things have changed over the years, and I asked Francois about this, because back in the day, we remember cigarette companies sponsoring all manner of sports, including in cycling. And in fact, Boule d'Or in the late 70s and early 80s was a cigarette company in Belgium, but they were banned from advertising in France. And so they simply found a chocolate company manufacturer and they paired up with them, and the Boule d'Or team carried on riding in France. So, you know, was it better back in the day? It wasn't. They were answering the same questions then as they're answering now. And just a final point on this, I do remember having a chat with somebody who was in a senior position at a team, talking about sponsorship in cycling. And I said, future generations may well look back at, and I was using the McLaren Bahrain tie-up as an example, look back at a tie-up between a supercar company and a petrochemical rich state and think, what on earth was cycling doing? And he said, yeah, I think you might be right. You know, future generations will look back and think that was kind of weird. But, you know, this is where sports sponsorship is, you know, across the board. It's not just cycling, but it is a conversation worth having, I think.
Absolutely. Tadej Pogacar will be pleased to be able to focus on the road tomorrow, even though we've got the Queen stage to look forward to, and it's going to be a tough one. We will come to that. Before we do, should we do any other business?
Let's, because it's rapidly becoming our favourite segment, if only for the name that you've come up with, Graham. Absolute genius. The question today comes from Simon, not Simon Gill, the photographer, but he asks Ian, there's several team leaders who don't seem to be competitive, or certainly not at the pointy end of the race. If you were in such a team, would you expect riders to start lobbying for a shot at a stage win or buckle down and try and turn things around? Well, probably a bit late for some of them to turn it around, but this is what Ian Boswell thinks. And Ian is answering this question as part of our title sponsorship from Wahoo Fitness. The question will continue through the Tour de France fam. So if you have a question specifically about the Tour de France fam, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Over to Ian.
Hey, Simon. Yes, I know exactly what you were talking about. The 2018 Tour de France with Katusha Alpecin, we were down to four riders with a handful of stages left and trying to move Ilnur Zakarin into the top 10, which ultimately we did, which meant the rest of us decided to, well, we didn't decide. We were told to commit to one rider and try to move him into the top 10. For a lot of teams at the Tour de France, a top 10 finish is still a big result and still a success. So it really comes down to the team's overall goals and ambitions. As the tour goes on, riders get more tired, more fatigued, and the realization of what can we actually do here becomes apparent, because winning a race from a breakaway is not easy. We've already seen that this year in the Tour de France. Someone like Ben Healy is clearly on flying form. He's won a stage. He's been able to move into the yellow. Is he going to win the race overall? Absolutely not. But does a rider like that show that they have the ability to maybe win another stage? You would then change your team's objective to try to commit to that rider and his overall ambitions versus, as we've seen with other riders you mentioned, some people are just not on form. They're not there. Ben O'Connor has been a great example this year of he's just off the mark. So for that team, for Jay Koalula, absolutely, they need to shift perspectives and goals and try to go for stage wins.
Brand brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
So, Lionel, we saw yesterday with Valentin Paris-Pantra's win on Vontu, pipping Ben Healy to the line. We saw France taste a little victory, but no prospect.
Big victory.
Sorry, that was underselling it. Faux pas from me.
Your apologies to the nation of France, there, yeah, Graham.
Quite right. Instant corrections corner. Appreciated. However, no sign of an overall victory, a GC man coming through for them just yet.
Well, come on to that in a minute. Well, it's 40 years since Bernardino last won the Tour de France for France. That was 1985. I was looking back at the latest point that the first French stage winner of a Tour de France has come in recent years. Famously, 1999, there was no French stage winner at all. I think that is the only time in the history of the race that that has happened. They didn't get a single stage win. In recent years, France has had a nervous old wait for a stage win. 2011, Pierre Roland won on Alpe d'Huez on stage 19. 2013, Christophe Riblon won on Alpe d'Huez, stage 18. And then 2016, Romain Bardet won in the Alps on stage 19. And then 3 years ago, 2022, Christophe Laporte won into Cahors on stage 19. So France wasn't running it quite as fine this week, but they will be relieved to have got a stage win at the beginning of the third week. Very impressive one by Valentin Paris-Pantre. But as you say, Graham, no overall contender, really. There's this young lad, 18 years of age, Paul Sexas, coming through Decathlon Agir d'Azur in a very, very impressive Dauphiné, where he finished in the top 10. I think he was 8th, could have been 6th, but for that weird crash on the final stage on the final climb. So there, everyone I've talked to about France ending the wait for a French Tour de France champion has mentioned Paul Sexas. But I kind of wanted to know what the impact of not having a French winner is on the race, on the country's relationship with the race. And I thought the best person to ask would be Alex Roos, who is the chief cycling correspondent of L'Equipe, a very, very fine writer. I also asked Cedric Vasseur, who is the general manager of Cofidis, and he made a very interesting point about the economics of sport in France, the taxation system, which makes it really hard for French teams to put a team on the pitch when other teams who are not subject to the same tax laws and are funded from other countries can basically, you know, up the ante and pay their riders a lot of money, knowing that almost all of that money will go directly to the riders, whereas there's significant taxation in France. So Alexander Roos talking about the French relationship with the Tour, with Cedric Vasseur making his point about the economics. Well, Alex, you were 3 years old when Bernardino won the Tour de France in 1985. You fell in love with cycling even though French riders weren't winning the Tour. Does it matter that it's been 40 years since a French rider won?
Actually, no, because otherwise I wouldn't have fallen in love with cycling, as you said. And I think, you know, the French people, they're looking for someone after Hino to win the Tour, but on the other hand they also like the loser side of a story, and so I think they like, in a way they like the fact that we don't have a French guy able to win the Tour, and so yeah, the story goes on, and each summer it's the same. This year it's even more important because of obviously it's 40 years since the last win in the Tour. So I think French people like it both ways, having someone or not, actually.
In the time you've been covering cycling, did you think at any stage, maybe this year, maybe this rider, Bardet or Pinot or anyone that you thought could possibly have won it?
Not really. I think we like to tell us a story that it was possible. But if you look at it, Bardet and Pinot, they were quite far from winning it. For me the edition that we really begin to believe was 2019, was of course with Pinot leaving the race with the feeling that he was the best in the mountains in the Pyrenees. Yeah, that's a hard story, and the more reasonable one is Bardet was not that far from Froome in 2017, but I think we didn't really believe in it.
And France has had some amazing riders in that time. Julian Alaphilippe's another one, but nothing that is quite the level enough to win the Tour de France.
No, because we lacked a guy that was a good, very good climber, of course, but that was also good on the TTs. And Pinot and Bardet and Alaphilippe, even if he won the TT in 2019, they were not good enough on the TT. So we never had the good combination for a rider in the last like maybe 15 years. I mean, French people, they also like the romance of winning stages, or as I was saying, just going to try to win it and losing. And so I never had the feeling that it was really bad for the French riders during the Tour, actually.
France paid a heavier price for the Festina affair because the laws changed in France and made it a criminal offence to dope in sport. That had a long impact, didn't it? While there was a period where France was operating at a different level to riders from other countries and teams from other countries.
Yeah, I think that was the feeling in 1999, that French teams, they really changed their behaviors. They were playing the same game before, and then they stopped because of Festina and because it was a public shame and everything. And then they realized that actually other teams were still doing the same thing or even worse. These years were very, very bad for French cycling, and also very hard. Guys like Sandy Cazard, he couldn't have won the Tour, of course, but he was quite a good rider, and he was riding clean, and he knew that the other riders weren't. So, yeah, that was quite tough, I think.
And what about for the future? Can you see a French winner in the next few years? Is there any hope?
Yeah, there's hope around Paul Sexas, I think, and there's but with a question mark because he's only 18, and even though riders now they have results very early, we still don't know what he can do, but it's quite promising. But you know, it's really the French also game to always when there's a good young rider, the question is already there. Can he win the Tour? And he didn't even have won one race on a professional level. So we should give him time. And also Kevin Vauclin, he's quite a good rider. He can climb. He's good on TT. He's only like 23 or 24 years old. So we don't know how he will develop. So we'll see.
And what about the pressure and the expectation in France? The fans, the media, the TV, L'Équipe?
Yeah, it's huge. I always tell the story that Thibaut Pinot in 2012, first Tour de France, he won a stage in the Porrentruy, top 10 in the GC. And at the end of the race, on the Tuesday, the L'Equipe's cover was can Thibaut Pinot win the Tour? And Marc Madiot, the manager of Pinot's team, was furious, called the newspaper and said, you're putting too much pressure on him, you're going to destroy him. So that's always been there. And it's funny because people say we shouldn't do the same with Paul Sexas, for instance, but actually everybody's doing the same again. So yeah, the pressure is huge in France for that.
So he's going to need some broad shoulders to cope with all of that expectation.
Yeah, and to have good people around him, protecting him, but also without protecting him too much. So that's a tricky balance to find. And I think Decathlon, AG2R, they have a plan to go with him. So we'll see.
And lastly, every year the Tour de France celebrates the history of French cycling. I mean, this week alone, we've been through Rouen, Jacques-Anquetil, Saint-Mans-le-Grand, Louis-en-Bobet, Ifignac, Bernardino, of course. The ghosts of French cycling are haunting the current riders wherever we go.
Yeah, of course, it's always there. It's also been 50 years since Bernard Thévenet beat Eddie Merckx in the Tour. I mean, we love it, but I think everybody that loves cycling loves it because it's the roots of cycling. It's why this sport is so rich, so inspiring. It's because of the past, and yeah, that's good to remember.
I mean, it's not because of the French is not in yellow jersey on the Champs-Élysées that French cycling is going bad. I mean, if you look Italy, we have the Giro d'Italia. We have no one Italian team in the UCI World Tour. So I think we are pretty rich in France about that. We are doing our best to improve years after years the level of the standard level of the teams. But it is also true that the concurrence is really high, with very huge budget teams, which are not having the same regulation. You know, we are having to pay taxes where they don't have to pay taxes. So I think it's not a fair competition.
Explain that about the tax, because as a French team, you have to pay all of the French taxes.
Yes.
To all of the riders, regardless of where they live. How does that work?
Yes. I mean, like, for instance, if you work with a French member, team staff members or riders, you have to pay 42.5% of tax to make health warranty, unemployed warranty, and so on and so on. So at the end of the day, if somebody costs you 100,000 euro, if you give him 100,000 in the pocket, it costs the team 142.5. So it's a lot more. So just imagine on champions now, who are having millions of euro of salaries, then it's really more heavy for us. And this is really a kind of unfair competition. When a rider is having a choice between a French and a foreign team, of course, he's earning always with a very high standard. He can have more money in the pocket with a foreign team. But I mean, money is not everything. Some people, they can come also in France for the structure, for the security, for a lot of things. But there's also a part of some people who are just saying, what I want is to earn the maximum money and I don't want to go in France.
One other point on that, of course, Lionel. No French team has won a race yet in this tour. Can we see them doing it tomorrow? I fear the answer might well be probably not.
Well, no. I mean, I know Lenny Martinez is very motivated to win tomorrow's stage. It's going to be very tough for him, but he's in the King of the Mountain jersey, but of course doesn't ride for a French team, rides for Bahrain Victorious. So, I mean, yeah, Groupama, FDJ, Decathlon, AG2R, they have a good shout with Felix Gall, I think. You know, he's an excellent climber and excels on the long climbs. But Cedric Vasseur's team, Cofidis, I mean, they're having quite a tough tour, aren't they? And it's not even as if they've got a real French DNA. They've only got three French riders in the lineup. Brian Coquart went home, of course, at the end of last week. So it's a real conundrum for the French teams.
Stage 18 then, tomorrow's stage. We won't do yesterday's dinner. We'll skip over this because we didn't have dinner.
We didn't have any dinner. We had nuts, basically. We had some nuts.
But they were quite convivial. It was
convivial.
Okay. Yeah. And we were watching the lionesses.
The thing was, it was our choice, wasn't it? We chose not to extend our evening by going for dinner and sitting and waiting and what have you. We were very, very tired after coming off the mountain. And, you know, we'd missed a night's sleep, really. So I think we were all prioritising a bit of shut-eye. So
Monster Munch nuts and beers from Simon's van once again.
Living the dream, Graham. Living the dream.
Indeed, and football on the telly. So tomorrow, stage Vif to Courchevel, and specifically the Col de la Loze, which will ring a bell for a particular quote which has come up a couple of times already this week from Tadej Pogačar, because this is the scene where he famously fell away from Jonas Vingegaard, and it said over the radio a couple of times, I'm dead.
Well, it's a high summit finish, isn't it? 2,300 metres. A little corrections corner here, because I think a few days ago when Lenny Martinez went over the Tourmalet first and won the souvenir Jacques Godet, I said that was the prize for reaching the top of the highest climb of the Tour first. It's not. It was for crossing the Tourmalet first. Tomorrow, the Col de la Loze is the souvenir Henri de Grange. It's the highest point in the race, 2,304 metres, and it follows two equally brutal climbs, the Col de Glandon and the Col de la Madeleine, both all-category climbs. And it's a real tough approach, that. And they go up to Courchevel and beyond. And that final climb up to the Col de la Loze is an absolute crawl, isn't it?
Yeah, 2023, of course, was when Pogačar fell away. So you've got to feel like, quick bit of speculation, but you've got to feel like he's got a wrong to right tomorrow. But it's a real Toblerone of a stage, isn't it? If you look at it, it's up, down, up, down, very little valley. And obviously the up to finish in Courchevel.
Yeah, he did hint that he's got unfinished business with the climb tomorrow. It's where Jonas Vingegaard, I mean, it wasn't even putting him to the sword, was it? Pogačar just ran out of gas after taking a beating in the time trial the previous day.
Yeah.
But it does feel very much like the boot is on the other foot at the moment. And I don't expect Pogačar to suddenly, you know, evaporate. I think he'll be fine. Worst case scenario for him, he'll just follow. But I suspect he'll stick around until it's time to make a move, and he'll try and win another stage.
5,450 metres of climbing tomorrow.
Yeah,
absolute beast.
They probably go downhill the same amount. So, I mean, it all equals out, doesn't
all
it?
All evens up. even Friday's stage is a big one, with 4,550 metres of vertical ascent to Le Plan. And then Saturday's hilly stage, hilly in sort of inverted speech marks, inverted commas, will mean another 2,900 meters of climbing there. So if the peloton aren't already on their knees, it's these last three stages before Paris are going to be just breathless, aren't they?
Epic, iconic stuff, Graham. Epic and iconic.
You've done a corrections corner. I'm going to let that go because you're tired. We're both tired. You've done a corrections corner. I'm afraid to say that I need to address something as well. Apologies to Felix, though, for the hot can of Fanta comments, or nugget, I should say, when we were talking about Eros Poli's famous climb to Ventoux in 1994 on yesterday's podcast. That was actually Felix's. I should have credited him from a podcast that we did together a few years ago called Recycle. It was his interview with Eros. So apologies, Felix. Credit where credit is due. But as I said to him, that's what Corrections Corner is for. That's partly what Corrections Corner is for.
Absolutely. A very quick one before we go. The Tour de France Femme is it's coming up very fast. It starts on Saturday. Rose Manley and Denny Gray will be on their way to Brittany for the opening stage. And the Cycling Podcast Femenans preview will be out very, very soon. I think it should be ready tomorrow morning. Kilometre Zeros continue. We've got a couple more things in the pipeline, but the final part of our three-part mini-series, Chapter and Verses with Shelley Verses, was released this morning. We're going to get back in touch with Shelley later on this year and get a few more of her stories on the record, because I found those really compelling listening. But Graham, we need to go and find somewhere to have dinner. We're on a trading estate, so my expectations are not terribly high, but having had nuts for dinner last night, I really can't miss dinner tonight. So.
No, this will be the first proper dinner in 3 nights, so we better get on with it.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.